Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's exactly 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for a Juneau afternoon. My guests today include Katie Bousler from up on the university campus, and Katie's going to be talking to us about the new spring schedule, which is just coming out. We'll have a lady named Kate Case join us from, actually, the SeaTac Airport, where she's stranded between flights at the moment. She's coming into town to give a presentation tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. out at Chapel by the Lake on sex trafficking. So we'll talk to her about her presentation. And then John Cooper is going to drop in. He's part of a team out at the National Marine Fisheries Service, the Ted Stevens Research Institute. They've come up with a new way to heat the place with seawater, and he's going to tell us about that and tell us about a presentation they'll be putting together on that. National Native News is next. Stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A school district in Northern California has voted to remove a high school mascot known as the Apaches. Zadie Stavely has more.
Of the more than two dozen speakers Wednesday night, only two spoke in support of the mascot, saying it was not disrespectful, but honoring. The rest overwhelmingly asked the board to remove the decades-long name of the Vallejo High School Apaches. Kim DeOcampo was one of them.
I am not a relic from Antiques Roadshow. I am a living and human being, and I am not a mascot.
Angelica Beta came to the meeting wearing a red sweatshirt that read Lady Apaches, ready to fight for the name that even her grandparents bore when they went to high school. With tears in her eyes, Beta says she was disappointed, but understood.
I didn't know that they felt that way about this. So, I mean, if they feel it's disrespectful, then let's get it changed by all means.
The Vallejo-based organization Sacred Sites Protection and Rights of Indigenous Tribes led the push to change the Apache mascot. Chairman Norman Wounded Knee DeOcampo says it's been more than a decade-long fight.
Across this nation, many, many Native American nations will listen to this board tonight of what you've done. You have made history.
Other organizations like the ACLU came to support the mascot change. Leaders estimate there are still 180 schools in California with Indian mascots. For National Native News, I'm Zadie Stavely in Vallejo, California.
Recovery efforts are underway in western Alaska coastal communities after recent storms. Zachariah Hughes reports on two villages that were among the hardest hit. Both have made disaster declarations with the state.
In Kotlik, floodwaters were followed by chunks of ice that plowed through buildings and infrastructure. Jimmy O'Kitkun lives in Kotlik and says the damage to the town was extensive.
Pipes torn from the houses. It's bad.
The Red Cross was the first relief organization to arrive in Kotlik and has since been coordinating disaster response efforts with the state as well as local and regional entities. 12 volunteers from Team Rubicon, the NGO made up of former military personnel, is slated to fly to Kotlik to help rebuild damaged homes. Both Stebbins and Kotlik experienced damage to their sewage systems. Surging waves rushed across homes and roads in Stebbins, toppling and carrying away large containers used to collect sewage from household honey buckets. That contamination has since been frozen and covered by snow, creating a potential health hazard once the spring thaw hits. And the rapid drop in temperature created other problems. Flooded homes and damaged heating units are frozen. Anna Neshonek works as a tribal family coordinator and lives in Stebbins.
The first thing that I'm concerned about is the heating of homes that were damaged. How are we going to get monitors or wood stoves out here to Stebbins to thaw out the homes that were damaged?
Residents also lost fishing nets, outboard motors, fish drying racks, and other vital tools for subsistence practices. At a community meeting on Tuesday, residents said Stebbins was saved by how people came together to help one another. Neighbors, elders, and family members were all accounted for, and as floodwaters rapidly rose during the height of the storm, whole families were carried to safety in the bucket of a large bulldozer. State Senator Donnie Olson was impressed with just how much care people showed for one another during the disaster.
And now we as a state need to go ahead and see what we can do to step up to the plate.
Senator Olson was the first public official to visit Stebbins since last week's devastating storm. Governor Sean Parnell, after his trip to Kotlik last week, was brought on a 30-second flyover to see the damage in Stebbins from above, but did not land. For KNOM in Nome, Alaska, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
In November 2012, the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, Crow Creek Sioux Tribe, and the Shakopee Mittewakanton Sioux Community reacquired Peshla, a sacred site in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The tribes say the Black Hills were protected by treaties but violated by the U.S. The tribes say the event was historic and healing for the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people. Landowners had originally put up the area for sale to the highest bidder, but later canceled a fall auction. A nationwide campaign helped raise money for the reacquisition. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just almost 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. A quick note here, the Love Incorporated Benefit Auction will be tonight at 7 p.m. It's being held at the chapel by the Lake Church. This is an evening of fun, fellowship, desserts, music auction items, and updates on the Love, Inc. ministry. All auction items are being sold to benefit the programs of Love, Inc. Tickets are available at the door for $25. If you'd like further information, you can call 780-4090. My first guest on Juneau Afternoon today is a familiar voice on the radio to us all. Katie Bosler is here. And Katie, I understand you're going to tell us a little bit about a new spring schedule out at UAS.
Yes, I am. Well, hello, Pat. Good to talk to you. And just want to let people know that there is both the print and the online version of our spring 2014 class schedule available. The print version was out in the Capital City Weekly within the last couple of weeks. And also, if you kind of go to your, you know, where you find your Capital City Weekly on the stands around, I know, like Heritage Downtown, there's a pile of our course schedules. There's a picture of some students enjoying the fall sunshine, kind of a little bit different scene than now in the courtyard, Morant Courtyard. And there's also a shot of some students standing on top of a mountain in Ecuador, some outdoor study students doing their capstone last January. The course schedule I just want to let people know that they can also, if you don't get the print version, you can always look up your courses and get information about them online. And I just thought I'd give people a little primer on that. If you go to uas.alaska.edu/schedule, you'll see two choices there, and you would click on the spring 2014 schedule. And then it's really kind of a very user-friendly interface here, where you can drop-down menu, go to your campus. That would be Juneau, Ketchikan, or Sitka, your subject. If you want the course by e-learning or in the classroom, title, day of week, start time, instructor, you can do any of these searches or even just search for the name of a course. Say you wanted to take cycling, indoor cycling with Fran Palumski. You could just kind of punch in spinning and you could you could find the course. So if people have any questions about that, this, of course, you can always come out to campus. You can come out to our Novotny One-Stop Welcome Center, and we have a front desk there, and people can answer any of your questions. We have all printed schedules available there, as well as people who can help you if you want to give them a call. If you don't want to come out to campus right away, the number is 796-6100, and again, if you want to look up these courses for the spring 2014 semester online, you can always go to uas.alaska.edu/schedule.
Katie, a couple of really interesting courses that people like to casually enroll in. Well, I guess a college course is never a casual enrollment process, but nonetheless, there are a number of art classes that are almost always offered, particularly the chance to do a little pottery or something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us a kind of an overview of what's in the schedule on the art
classes?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you for giving me something specific here. I should have thought of that. So if I go to let's say here I am on this page, right, where it says Spring Search at the top. So campus, I will drop down menu Juneau, subject, I've got art, and I'm going to say I want to look at all courses, any course, any day, any time, and I'm just going to click on the bottom, the button that says submit. And here is just a listing of all the art courses in Juneau. There's many. There's probably about 30 listed here, from beginning drawing to art appreciation to sculpture to history of world art to digital camera photography, beginning Northwest Coast basketry, ceramics, beginning intermediate and advanced, printmaking, something called Intermediate Northwest Coast Carving Halibut Club, senior drawing. So we have quite a variety of art classes right there.
And these are always popular with a lot of people who like to enroll in a course to kind of pick up some new art skills or refine their abilities or something like that. The other
well,
area.
Well, that's the thing, yeah, is that we do have, you know, we have a, you can major in art here. You can get a Bachelor of Art in Arts, or if you're, say, we do have some students who are retired from their careers or working part-time and kind of scaling back from their career, and they come out and take art classes and find them quite fulfilling. Also, I mean, I know a lot of people listening in this town may be working full-time and maybe have never quite finished their college degree. Well, here at UAS, the door is always open, and you know, you can take classes through e-learning or at night, and you can finally finish that degree, and that can often help for promotions at work or just for your own, finally, I did it.
You bet. And that's really there are a lot of people that I've had experience with in the past. I taught in college for quite a number of years. And the wonderful feeling of accomplishment that someone has if they go back and finally put it together and do it. It's
yep.
just beyond belief. Watching them walk across the stage and get their diplomas was the highlight of my educational career, I have to say. The other area that I think a lot of people are interested in are courses in, I don't know whether you call them activities or physical education or exactly what the heading would be under, but there are a number of opportunities to take a class in yoga or Tai Chi, I believe, is still offered up on the campus, and I don't know. How would someone get to those listings?
Okay, well, what you would do then is you would go to physical education under your drop-down for subject. And as a matter of fact, I misspoke earlier. I said you could punch in spinning. No, you want to go to physical education. Let's say, again, the Juneau campus. And I'm just going to click on, there we go. And, yeah, we have everything from cardio dance to gentle yoga to indoor cycling, to Latin dance, this is a very good one for those who are interested in backcountry skiing. We have an avalanche evaluation and theory course, and we also have some outdoor studies classes included here with the physical education, wilderness first responder recertification, and glacier travel and crevasse rescue fundamentals are just a couple.
So, once again, the dates to be registered for a spring schedule class?
Let's take a look here. I think our, let's see here. Yeah, so the registration has opened up here, and yeah, okay, so what we've got is the registration's started for program students November 11th, and then this is a timely call because as of Monday, that's the 25th of November, registration is open to all students.
Okay.
So far it's been program students who are already enrolled, but as of Monday it's everybody. And the classes start January 13th, 2014.
And as you said, a person could register for a class completely online. In other words, they can go from finding the class on your web page all the way through to getting their name on the roll sheet for that class.
Yes, yes. You would enroll through the University of Alaska, something called UA Online, and there's a link right there on the course schedule homepage.
Okay. Or they can come up and see the friendly staff in the one-stop shop where you can basically do your whole registration by just going from one counter to another and walk away with the paperwork in your hand. And
The old-fashioned way, the Novotny One-Stop Center.
And if you have questions, 796-6100 get them answered right away. Huh?
That's it.
Katie,
thank
you so much for filling us in. Everybody can look around town and find those printed copies of the schedule, but even more convenient and perhaps complete is to go on the webpage, which is www.uas.alaska.edu, and find
slash
the way
schedule.
To slash schedule. We'll put
you right on the page
where you can do the job.
Or if you don't remember that, we have a really nice little oval box on the right-hand side of the upper right-hand corner of our homepage. It says Search UAS, and just punch in their course schedule.
Outstanding. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Have a good weekend.
See you later. Bye.
All right.
You
bye.
You must learn what you have learned.
Oh, so you're saying I should bid online and not call in for the auction. All right, I'll give it a try.
Try not. Do or do not. There is no try.
Fine. The KTO Holiday Auction is happening November 25th through December 5th with the most epic items from Juno Dance Unlimited, Orso, and Peaky's Fish Market, and more. What's that, Chewy? Oh, yeah, and it's on the website at ktoo.org.
This is Bird Note. It's early morning on the island of New Guinea. The lowland forest erupts with the crowing calls of male Ragayana birds of paradise. Groups of male Ragayana birds of paradise perform elaborate displays to attract females. The size of small crows, the males have a yellow head, bright green throat, and a lush mass of fine russet orange plumes that hang well beyond their tails. In a sequence known as the flower display, the males hang upside down with their wings flexed downward while flaunting those russet plumes upward. Birds of Paradise, an aptly exotic name for this most varied and extravagantly decorated group of birds. All 43 species are found on New Guinea or nearby. Picture one named the ribbon-tailed astropia as it flies along the forest edge. With an emerald green head and velvety black body, the astropia trails two slender white tail plumes a full 3 feet behind its body. They undulate like fine ribbons in the breeze. Can't travel to New Guinea? Well, bring birds into your home year-round with the Bird Note calendar. Available at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
It's 18 minutes and 10 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next guest is coming to us by way of telephone also, and this is Kate Case. Kate is at the moment stranded in the SeaTac airport between flights. Tell us how that all came about, Kate.
Well, Juneau decided to get a little bit of extra snow yesterday, and I guess the airlines are a little bit backed up, so I am headed out there tonight.
So, and the reason you're coming to town is to give a presentation at 6:30 tomorrow night, so we still have another day to get you here, at Chapel by the Lake, and the subject of this is an extremely important subject, and that is basically human slavery, human trafficking.
Yes.
The organization that you're with, I'm not sure we're all familiar with. You are, your title is Organizing and Advocacy Fellow for the International Justice Mission. Could you give me a little background on IJM?
Absolutely. It's International Justice Mission is a human rights agency that brings rescue to victims of slavery, sexual exploitation, and other forms of violent oppression around the world. So our lawyers, our investigators, and aftercare professionals will work with local officials secure immediate victim rescue, aftercare, as well as prosecute perpetrators and ensure that public justice systems are working for the poor in various countries.
And so where is your headquarters when you aren't on the road or caught in airports?
Well, our actual office headquarters is back in Washington, D.C., but I live out in California.
Okay, and so you're based out of Sacramento, I think.
Yes.
Okay, and so you do work with an agency here in the state of Alaska, though, is that correct?
Well, there's actually another national agency, and it's called Polaris Project, and we've partnered with them over the past couple of years because they really are specialists at state legislation. So we've worked with them on different state laws, not in Alaska, but in California and a few other states around the U.S.
Now, I was taking a look at the Polaris Project webpage, and I understand that they one of the things that they do is to track the presence or absence of 10 categories of state statutes critical to the comprehensive anti-trafficking legal framework. And Alaska's rating is Tier 1, which they rate as a green rating. And I understand from this that we're given a total of 7 points for having laws which I gather deal with sex trafficking, labor trafficking, asset forfeiture, investigative tools, training for law enforcement, no requirement of force, fraud, or coercion for sex trafficking of minors, and civil remedies. But according to this rating, which is from 2013, the state does not have necessary or what they view as necessary regulations for task forces. We evidently don't have a task force. I guess that's what that means. Posting of the national hotline, safe harbor for minors, or victim assistance, or vacating convictions. And so then the rest of their website breaks down the exact statutes that they reviewed in order to determine each one of these things. I'm assuming a report like that exists for every state in the United States.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know what the meaning of that Tier 1 green status? Is that saying that Alaska is doing well in this critical area?
Yeah, it's definitely a positive rating, and I think that one of the critiques of having a task force is really in how communities gather together to figure out best practices. Polaris Project is great as far as advocacy on the state and local level, as well as national level, and IJM has come alongside for those things, as well as for federal policies that have international implications as well.
Do you know, I'm looking at your biography, and I understand that you you're part of the organizer for a thing called the California Lobby Day?
Yes, we have a California Lobby Day.
Do you know if there's anything similar to that in the state of Alaska?
We haven't had something like that in Alaska yet. We have a very strong constituency in California of really some self-starters who wanted to go to California's capital and lobby on behalf of especially minors who are victims of sex trafficking within California. And so that's really how the California Lobby Day came about.
Now, you're giving a talk and having some conversation at Chapel by the Lake at 6:30 tomorrow evening. What do you plan to cover during that time?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about International Justice Mission and the 6 different types of casework that we work on internationally, as well as how people in Alaska can get involved and come in together and to collaborate for advocating to their state and federal policymakers about human trafficking issues, specifically around the bill that is in the House and the Senate right now, in the federal House and Senate, called the Human Trafficking Prioritization Act.
And can you give me an idea of that, of the content of that act? What legislation is needed in order to address this problem on a fuller basis?
Sure. Well, this is, again, one small step. There are so many pieces of legislation that have gone through so far, and this is really the next step in making sure that the U.S. stays as a leader in the fight against human trafficking. And it's by taking some very simple steps. There's a Trafficking in Persons Office, which is really our expertise in this, located in the State Department, and it's asking for the elevation of that to a bureau, which actually carries no more bureaucracy than what we normally think of. It's actually more efficient, and it costs the same amount of money without hiring any additional staff. So that's the piece of legislation we're lobbying on. We can get more into it tomorrow night if people come, but it sounds more wonky than what it actually is, and it really keeps the U.S. as a leader.
Is wonky a technical term?
Wonky, I guess it's more of a D.C. term, yeah.
I guess the other thing I'm wondering is, you sound very knowledgeable in this area, and I sense a kind of an interest in your job, in your voice. How did you come to become an organizing and advocacy fellow?
So it's a very long story. Again, I can chat more about it at 6:30 tomorrow for people who come. But it really started off with a professor who was very inspiring when I was writing the paper in my undergraduate work.
Where was that?
That was at La Sierra University, which is a small Christian college in Southern California.
And you were writing this paper on human trafficking?
I was writing the paper on human trafficking and what's happening in different societies and how different countries are addressing the problem.
And you came to that subject for the paper because there were lots of listings on the Wikipedia site? Or
you know, that again is a long story, how I came up with that subject. But I really had great supportive professors all around, and so I think I really credit it to them.
Well, it sounds like you're going to do an excellent presentation. Is this open to the public?
It is, and I would love to see anyone who comes answer any questions that you may have. I really want to get a feel for Juno more and the people who are there.
Okay. Well, there's quite a number of us here. There's 31,000 people in the state's capital, so we're hoping that some of them will come out tomorrow night at 6:30. So this is at Chapel by the Lake. The conversation begins at 6:30 in the evening. I'm assuming there's no charge for the talk.
No, no charge.
Okay.
And people can also email me at kcase, so kcase@ijm.org, with any other questions. If it's not possible for them to make it out.
Okay, and the topic of your talk is on basically human trafficking, human slavery, and they're representing the International Justice Mission, which works in the state of Alaska with the Polaris Project, which is another national organization, and that partnership will continue, as I understand it.
Yeah, and we're working mostly internationally, but we do work with gathering people in Alaska as well as in other states.
Kate, I hope you get out of Seattle okay and on your way to Juneau. I wish you a good flight, and look forward to hearing from you tomorrow night at 6:30 at Chapel by the Lake.
Thank you, Pat.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 22nd of November, 2013. It's the birthday of André Gide, born in Paris, 1869. André Gide, who said, "Everything that needs to be said has already been said, but since no one was listening, everything must be said again." It's the birthday of the graphic artist and author and film director Marzan Satrapi, born in Rasht, Iran, 1969. Satrapi was a young girl during the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Her parents sent her off to Vienna to escape the resulting fundamentalism, and she wrote a graphic memoir about her experience in that time, Persepolis, the story of what it was like to be an Iranian girl, suddenly segregated from boys in school and forced to wear a hijab or a headscarf. Published in 2000 in French, and then in 2007, Satrapi co-wrote and co-directed a movie adaptation of Persepolis, which got an Academy Award nomination for Best Animated Feature. Her recent autobiographical comics include Embroideries, the story of Satrapi's grandmother and aunts and the men they've loved, and Chicken with Plums, a chronicle of her great-uncle's last 8 days of life. It's the birthday of the novelist George Eliot, born Warwickshire, England, 1819, the pen name of Mary Ann Evans. We know her as the author of Adam Bede and Middlemarch. She was a famously unattractive woman. Henry James wrote that Eliot was magnificently ugly, deliciously hideous. She lived for 23 years with a man named George Lewis, though they never married, and she took his first name for her pseudonym, George Eliot. She was 40 years old when she published her first short story. She thought that choosing a pseudonym would cover her tracks. She was, after all, living unmarried with a married man. But her first novel, Adam Bede, was a huge success. People speculated about who George Eliot might be, and Marianne Evans was forced to reveal herself. It was on this day, 1963, about 12:30 in the afternoon, President John F. Kennedy was fatally shot while riding in a motorcade in Dallas, Texas. The Warren Commission concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in shooting the president, a conclusion that less than half of all Americans believe. Don DeLillo's novel, Libra, is about the Kennedy assassination. He wrote, "What has become unraveled since that afternoon in Dallas is the sense of a coherent reality most of us shared. We seem from that moment to have entered a world of randomness and ambiguity." Here's a poem for today by Edgar Allan Poe, entitled Hymn. At morn, at noon, at twilight dim, Maria, thou hast heard my hymn. In joy and woe, in good and ill, Mother of God, be with me still. When the hours flew brightly by, and not a cloud obscured the sky, my soul, lest it should truant be, thy grace did guide to thine and thee. Now, when storms of fate o'ercast darkly my present and my past, let my future radiant shine with sweet hopes of thee and thine. A Hymn by Edgar Allan Poe. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. Northland Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
Tonight on 360 North at 8 o'clock, join 360 North's new public affairs discussion series, Forum at 360. The documentary The Kennedy Half Century at 9 examines the legacy of the 35th President's life and administration. At 10, Great Decisions in Foreign Policy leads the weekly wrap-up, followed by Platt's Energy Week, This Week in Defense News, and BioCentury This Week. It's a great way to look at public affairs tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
It's about 26 minutes, 27 minutes before 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is a surprise to me. I know John as an outstanding bass, whom I sang next to it as we did King Island Christmas about 20 times over the last season. And it turns out that he is also a very qualified mechanical engineer who's responsible for a lot of the design work on a really innovative heating system for the Ted Stevens Research Institute that NASA runs here in town. Hi, John.
How you doing?
I'm good. Like I said, this is an unusual way to see you, because normally I'm looking at you in profile from the side and trying desperately to sing with you to stay on pitch.
It would probably be good if we don't do any singing today.
Let's stay away from it. But that certainly was a lot of fun to take the show to Scotland last summer. And
it absolutely was.
It absolutely was. So, your day job is that of one of the mechanical engineers out at the...
Yeah, I'm the facilities manager for all the NOAA facilities that are here in Juneau, and our premier facility being the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute out at Lena Loop or Lena Point.
So were you on staff when that was being built?
I was not. I was working for the Coast Guard while the facility was being built and trying to figure out what that was that they were doing.
Uh-huh.
I moved over to work with NOAA in 2010. So about this time in 2010, I was starting out there.
John, the facility is a ways out on Lena Loop Road, and I'm not sure that everybody in town has been there at least once. So could you kind of describe what's there?
Well, there used to be a rock quarry on Lena Point. It's where the AT&T tower is, where the communications used to come into Juneau from the north. And we have our facilities there. We pump the seawater up, and we work with the fish, the animals, and do a lot of really good research there.
There's several buildings on the campus out there.
I'm not sure exactly what all they are. Yeah, we've got about 65,000 square feet out there of heated space, and then I've got a warehouse and workshop area, and then some other buildings that support the facility.
So this whole 6,500-foot square foot area now is heated almost exclusively by heat pumping out of seawater, is that right?
Yeah, I like to tell people that we heat our facility with seawater, which really causes people to raise an eyebrow. But we do. We extract heat from the seawater. We're already pumping the seawater up to 600 gallons per minute through the facility for our animals. And we run that through a heat exchanger, and then we extract the heat from it in much the same way that out at the airport and at the Diamond Aquatic Center, and soon next door to you at the museum, they're going to be pulling the heat out of the ground.
I was as they were constructing the museum, I kept seeing them putting they were drilling, and I wondered what it was, but then I realized that they're planning on doing the same kind of heating.
Yeah, they'll be doing the same heating, and in their case, I'd say that they're almost doing seawater heat pump too, because we're so close to the channel here that I know that they did hit water when they went down.
They certainly did. It was quite apparent. So this is kind of like a real strange mystery, because it has to do with the little tiny difference in temperature between two places. That's really where you derive this heat when you work with the heat pump.
That's
but the
correct.
Temperature difference does not have to be very dramatic.
No, it's the device that does it. The heat pump is the magic box that where the work occurs. And I like to compare the heat pump to the freezer or the refrigerator in your house. So in the refrigerator in your house, you extract the heat from your food to keep your food cool. And, you know, in our house, we're bringing it from room temperature down to below 32 degrees or someplace like that. Well, in this case, and then after it brings that heat out, where does the heat go? Well, it goes out of the back of the refrigerator. So you've got the warm air blowing out of the back of the refrigerator. Well, with our heat pump, we just take that same type of scenario. We take the seawater that goes in, we extract about 5 degrees of temperature from that seawater, and then out of the back of the heat pump, we get the heat out that we use. And because we're subtracting about 5 degrees, it really doesn't matter where we subtract the 5 degrees. We could extract the 5 degrees from 70 degrees down to 65 degrees, like your refrigerator, or we could take the heat from the seawater. In our case, we're going from, in the wintertime, about 38 degrees down to 33 degrees. So we get that 5 degrees of temperature, and then we use that to heat the water that goes through our air handlers in the system.
Now, just before we open the microphones, you and I talked about the fact that the freezing temperature of seawater is probably somewhere around 28 degrees
something
or so.
Something like that, yes.
So I guess the question is, if you get water in that's only 4 degrees above that temp value, say your input water is like at 32 degrees, does your system then shut down?
The system would then shut down. We could, if that happened, then we would have to shut the system down. And we do still have the boilers that were in place when the building was built, just in case. And, you know, when we have problems, you know, periodically the heat pump needs to be serviced and we'll have to shut things down. The boilers can take over at any time and provide our heat. But since March of 2011, we've had the main boilers on less than 48 hours at a time.
The other question is, the seawater just passes through a coil, so there's no pollution involved in the – you don't pollute the seawater in the
we
course
don't.
Of doing it.
In fact, one of the things that we had issues with was how do you write a water discharge permit for this? There are laws that say that you can't heat the water up as it goes out so that we don't create an artificial warm spot in the ocean. But there's nothing that currently that is regulating what happens if you cool the water as it's coming out. And we cool the water when you add it with the rest of the seawater that's going out there, you know, just a couple of degrees. And the folks over at Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation weren't exactly sure how to treat that. They knew they had to include it in the permit, but they didn't quite know what to do with it.
So there's no law regulating how cold you can make the seawater when you discharge it.
Correct.
An outstanding concept. So the other question, I guess, do the labs get the water before or after you take the 5 degrees out?
The labs get the water before we take the 5 degrees out.
Okay.
So we're actually, our lab and the University of Alaska Fairbanks lab, the seawater goes into all of our labs, and then after
the University of Alaska Fairbanks lab is here.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. The University of Alaska Fairbanks lab is on our property,
right,
out at Lena Point.
Okay.
That's where their fisheries school is. Now, not to be confused with the University of Alaska Southeast Fisheries School, which is at Auk Bay.
Right.
But
and is heated probably by boilers.
By boilers.
Okay.
But we send the water through the lab, so it might pick up a little bit of heat as it's going,
yeah,
through the lab, and then we extract that heat back out.
Okay. So I guess the other now they're working with fish that are in that water. So
right.
Did you have to design some kind of system to get the fish out of the water before you ran it into your heat exchanger?
Well, the water is filtered before it goes in into the habitats where the fish are.
Okay.
So our water is very clean to start with. And then after it goes through the habitats, we send it through a ozone purifier, which would, you know, kill anything that might be in there. And then once it comes out of there, it goes through a couple of basket strainers. But we just recently cleaned our heat exchangers after 3 years of operation, and they were clean. There were no problems.
That was going to be my other question. Designing structures that will withstand the corrosive effects of seawater.
Yeah, we're using titanium heat exchangers.
No kidding.
So they're really slick and they're flat plates. So when you take them apart, you just take the plates out and wire brush them clean. If there's anything on them, put them back together again.
John, a titanium heat exchanger has got to be a fairly expensive little initial purchase. What's the payback looking like on this project?
Well, we figure that it cost us about $500,000 in materials for this. Now, one of the things that we did different than most government contracts is that we purchased the materials, and then we used our own in-house labor to do the lion's share of the work. So we figure we spent less than $1 million on this entire process. And this, combined with some of the other things that we have done out there, we figure that we're saving about 120,000 gallons of fuel a year.
Mm.
So, you know, today's fuel price is $4 a gallon. $500,000 a year is what we're saving by not heating with fuel oil right now.
So the payback is pretty
well
short, accomplished.
Yes.
Even with titanium
heat exchangers. And the irony there is when we bought the heat exchangers, we got a really good deal. So we bought two of them.
So what are you going to do with the other one?
Well, we have them standing side by side, and we can switch back and forth.
Okay.
So they can clean without having to shut the system down.
Is there any extension of this to home heating?
There is. There are a few homes here in Juneau that are heated with seawater heat pumps.
Really?
Water heat pumps. The trick is that you have to be next to the water. So if you have a waterfront lot here in Juneau, then there's the possibility for you to be able to do this.
I have no idea what the cost would be. I mean, $500,000 is going to cover 65,000 square feet. Do you have any concept of what it would cost to convert a house sitting next to, say, any body of water around here?
I would think...
That's probably an unfair question.
Yeah, I would think it wouldn't be that much different than if you were putting in a ground source heat pump.
Yeah.
I know a couple of people in town that have put in ground source heat pumps where, just like out at the airport, they run the pipes down in their backyard.
Right.
In the case of a house and extract the heat from the ground. I would expect that it would be about the same cost.
So comparable cost, and then just run seawater in through it.
Just running seawater in and a heat exchanger like you would have on your boat for the cooling water on your boat. You'd just be exchanging, having two different loops, the seawater loop and the loop that's going into
it. When we had the engineers that did the airport thing, one of the things that they pointed out is that you just keep doing it over and over until you get the temperature rise that you want.
Right.
Yeah. So, in other words,
it's the delta T, the change in temperature, that's important. It's not not going from the initial temperature to what you finally get it. It's those small change in temperature. That's what makes the magic work.
Yeah. And then we were talking with Alan Mesdag, who works with AALNP, and he mentioned the idea of using one heat source to get you to, say, 65 degrees in your home or 60, and then an additional heat source from another source to get the other 10, so that you would have a base that might come from heat pumps and then augment that with fuel oil or electricity or one of the other heat sources for the other 10 degrees, so that you basically would, you might not have to convert the whole system or come up with a device.
Correct.
That would raise the temperature of a dwelling, for instance, from external temperature all the way up to 70. For comfort indoors.
Yeah, that's something that would work well. A lot of houses have baseboard heating.
Uh-huh.
And one of the drawbacks of heat pump heat is that it's not very hot. So about 120 degrees. And to go through a baseboard, you want about 145 to 155 degrees.
And when we were discussing exactly that point with him, we did the interview out at one of the power plants here in town. He was pointing out the fact that it would be very easy with a heat pump to bring the temperature up to somewhere in the 60s, and then to gain the other 5 to 10 degrees that you might want for human comfort by just adding electricity in on top of it.
Adding electricity on top of that, and electricity is very easy to govern. And then you would have a green home. You, like our facility, one of the unique things about Juneau is that with our hydroelectric power from AALNP,
precisely,
we aren't using any fuel. Mm-hmm. So we've got a 65,000 square foot facility, and it is the largest facility in NOAA that is green, because our electricity is green. We're not using any fuel no fuel is being used to create the electricity or transport it to us, and then we've got the heat pumps that are using the electricity to extract the heat from the seawater.
John, as I understand it, the Sea Life Center down in Seward came down and basically copycatted your system?
Yeah. Absolutely. No, really. We had our system up and operating. They came down and looked at it. They were working on the design for their system. They ended up using the same compressors that we have in our system, same heat pump. And in their system, much like we were just talking about, because they have baseboard heat, they use their system to supplement, and then they have to use a little bit of oil to get them all the way there, whereas with our system, we are 100% heat pump.
Outstanding. And you've actually won an award on this.
We did.
Yeah, Lean, Clean, and Green, and this is part of the government award system.
Yeah, this is President Obama's Green Government Awards. There were 7 finalists in 7 different categories, so we won in our category as the Lean, Clean, and Green category.
Well, outstanding. I guess it's not probably, you can't take a tour here. There's probably not to see. Although I have to say, on our website, Matt Miller did a wonderful little took a camera out with him when he did an interview with you for the news program. And there's an excellent set of photographs of the system out there on our website. So somebody wants to see John Cooper standing next to his heat exchangers and heat pumps, that's indeed exactly what we have on the local news section of the KTOO news site.
And we do have organized tours, people that come in and take a look at it. So the Coast Guard engineers have come in and taken a look at it. And we've had one group of city planners in Canada come down and take a look at it. So people who are interested should get in touch with us, and we may be able to arrange something.
John Cooper, facilities manager for the Ted Stevens Research Institute, Juneau, Alaska, heating 65,000 square feet of buildings out there on Lena Point Road by pumping seawater into heat exchangers and bringing the temperature up gradually but very effectively, a totally green heating process. Thank you so much for sharing the details of this really interesting project with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. Mudrooms is, we're in the middle of the mudroom season, and December 23rd we'll be airing the entire program of the mudrooms, but right now we're going to see a little sneak preview here, and here it comes, one of the mudrooms presentations from this last month.
Our last speaker tonight is Tony Tengs. Tony was born at the former St. Anne's Hospital on 6th Street. He hasn't made it very far in life. He's been self-deployed, chasing rainbows most of his life, but his day job as a bartender on the Alaska Marine Highway keeps him afloat. His friends tell him not to give up his day job. He once entertained a gentleman for 3 days whose 15 minutes of fame would be as the recipient of a shotgun blast to the face from Vice President Dick Cheney. Although he was raised in Haines, his mother assures him he was conceived at the Capitol Hotel in Whitehorse. Tony believes this fact could be grounds for dual citizenship and that right-to-lifers should heartily concur. Welcome to the stage, our last speaker tonight, Tony Tang.
I'm going to tell you about my lucky scars, all of which, three lucky scars anyway, that are related in that I didn't know about them while they were happening. My first memory is associated with a scar. I'm in a crib, looking through the slats, and it's a brightly lit room, and a fellow is presenting a little brown bottle to me, and that has some fluid in it and a bone, and I'm understanding that bone has come from my foot, which is bandaged. And has a toe, one of my toes, which had been removed. My mother had taken me to Sitka to see this surgeon who was going to do the honors of taking one of my toes off because I was a polydactyl baby. And so he had done such a thing, and he took off basically what was then, up till then, my ring toe, which is the one next to the little piggy, the one that goes wee, wee, wee all the way home. He took off the ring toe, and the entire metatarsal bone that goes up the foot. So I had a scar going up my foot. He did the best job he could dealing with such a small, fine baby's foot. And, but as I grew up, that scar also grew up. And grew in proportion to me growing up until, you know, what had been former little teeny suture marks, probably as close as the doctor could get, were now an inch apart. So these little, it looked very crude and looks very crude to this day. I was very embarrassed about that scar. And when I'd be out in public, say at a beach with my friends, I would oftentimes bury that part of my foot in the sand or cover it up with my right foot. You know, because we always want to fit in and look like everybody else. And everyone was trying to be Barbie and Ken and look bilaterally symmetrical and beautiful. And I was not bilaterally symmetrical and beautiful. But anyway, I know my mother and my dad, they wanted me to be bilaterally symmetrically beautiful. And they didn't want me to be a curiosity in that regard of having a sixth toe. And they had the operation done. Plus, there was a, I thought that maybe I could just, it'd be easier to buy shoes, buy them off the rack, and not have to have special shoes made. My godparents, God bless them, they told me it was a lucky thing, a very lucky sign to have this sixth toe, and I should be thankful for it. And it was very charming and sweet of them to tell me that, and even though it was charming and sweet, you know, I do think there was something to that. One of the other memories after that of a scarring event was 2 years later when I was four. I woke up in a hospital in Whitehorse. And once again, bright lights and my eyes adjusted to the light and seeing a room full of toys, which were all for me. I had been through an accident. I'd apparently flown through the windshield of our Lincoln Continental. And I head on with a pickup truck just south of Watson Lake. My mother and I were riding in the car, which was being driven by my godmother's brother, while my father was back in Haines. And we did this head on. And we were very lucky. I was in the 80 percentile seat in the passenger seat on my mother's lap. So I was her seatbelt. And I had just flown through. And fortunately, it was a window which breaks and causes scars and not something very solid that my head would have just splatted against. And we survived that. My mother also took care of me, apparently having survived something of concussion proportions. She really apparently just helped take care of me during that accident. And also, fortunately, there was a hearse being driven by some beatniks. Really? I mean, this was 1958. They were beatniks, okay? Before the hippies. And they were behind us in the road, and they stopped, took their crap out of the hearse and put us in and drove us into Watson Lake, where I was flown to into the hospital in Whitehorse. And, I mean, some say what a miracle it was that I survived. I think, you know, my fairy godmother was working overtime that day. I'm thankful about that. Some people say, well, you know, there are various factors. It was my hard Neanderthal head, you know, which saved me, or the steel they put in those Lincoln Continentals. Personally, I think it was a combination, a holy trinity of the beatniks, my mama, and the ghost of my lucky baby toe. That was the holy trinity on that one. The other little scarring event is really something. It's not much that people talk about that much. It's something that is very bilaterally symmetrical in a beautiful and central way. And it's something that a lot of boys don't learn about until much years and years and years later. And you hear about being circumcised and you go, what? What the heck? And you go, well, that doesn't matter. And then you read in Science News about all the extra pleasure receptors in that extra tissue. And you go, man, I got ripped off. And you don't feel lucky. But then you think about it. And you go, dang. If I had any more receptors down in that pleasure center, I wouldn't get anything done. So, you thank your lucky scars. Thank you.
The entire Mudrooms presentation will be on the air on December 23rd here on KTOO. So if that's any example, just stay tuned. And you are tuned to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on translators. K276AF is in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay. K269AO is in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. K201AM is in Gustavus. K220BT in Hoonah. And K210AS is in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, we're on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online on ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from, thank you very much, listeners like you. Those strong winds are going to continue through this evening with tonight rain heavy at times and lows around 36 or so. Southeast winds 25 miles per hour will decrease to 10 to 20 miles per hour late, but we will still have gusts to 40 miles per hour this evening, and then rain in the morning. Tune in on Monday. Christy Chambord will be here to highlight the KTOO auction. We'll hear about Big Brothers and Big Sisters with Gretchen Durking, a preview of Tuesday's Native American Heritage Month lecture with guest David Katsik, and Connor O'Day will come by to talk about the Bridge Adult Gay Center. Joan Partis will be your host. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.